story of a Hasidic rabbi who was renowned for his piety. And he was unexpectedly confronted one day by one of his young, devoted, youthful students who burst into the room with feeling and said, "My teacher, I love you." And the old master looked up from his books and asked, "My student, do you know what hurts me?" The young student was somewhat puzzled and stuttering said, I don't understand your question, Rabbi. I'm trying to tell you how much you mean to me, and you confuse me with irrelevant questions." The rabbi replied, "My question is neither confusing nor irrelevant. For if you do not know what hurts me, how can you truly, truly love me?" Truly, love is built on understanding, which includes knowing the deeper story, our vulnerabilities, our soft underbelly, what hurts us, what scares us, and also our most precious hopes and dreams. And that's where trust comes in. Sociologist Brené Brown defines trust as choosing to make something that's important to you vulnerable to the actions of others. Choosing to make something that's important to you vulnerable to the actions of others. There's risk involved there. Sharing all of who we are in the fullness of our humanity is based on our ability to take those risks, to trust one another. It's trust that really allows us to connect with one another in that fullness of all that we are, to bring all of ourselves into a relationship. Trust is what allows us to truly see and be seen by others. Holding each other's vulnerabilities in trust is at the heart of our first principle, affirming the worth and dignity of every person. In the reading we just heard, Walter Royal Jones seems to be saying that congregational life is really all about building trusting relationships. Maybe not all of what it's about, but it certainly is foundational in our lives together. One of the most precious gifts and daunting responsibilities of congregational life is holding what's most important to one another in trust. I imagine we've all had experiences of knowing what trust feels like and what it feels like to have our trust betrayed. And I can imagine that there are those of you who have had both of those experiences of deep and abiding trust and betrayal in church. Churches are human communities. At our best, we are finite and fallible, not always able to show up in exactly the way we want to be there for one another. And so building trust requires intention and focus, right? It's something that we can practice. There's a practice in the Buddhist tradition called beginning anew. We always have the opportunity to begin again in a place of presence and openness to one another. But how do we do that? One way is by setting an intention, as I mentioned, stating the commitment we have to one another to hold one another's vulnerabilities in trust. And in the coming months, I will be encouraging us to develop together a covenant of right relations. Those commitments that we can all make to one another about how we choose to be together in community, Right? You would think it's a no-brainer, but we all need help with that. And when we remind one another of our intentions, we increase the likelihood that we'll actually be present for each other in the ways that we hope to be. Right? None of us ever want to betray someone else's trust. It's just something that happens in little ways, usually, sometimes bigger ways, but mostly in little ways. Another way to build trust is to focus on what it means to trust yourself, knowing where to place your trust. As I mentioned, trust is about risk, and only we can really know when it feels like it's right or okay to share our vulnerabilities with one another. There's a lot of talk about safety and creating safe spaces in community, and very rarely does that include what you bring in terms of creating your own safety in the context of a community. It's very important. There is no such thing as a safe space. Only you can make yourself safe in the context of community. You choose to risk. You choose to make yourself vulnerable. It's a good idea sometimes, not so good at other times, but we really have to learn what's best for us in that context. But when it comes to building trusting relationship, it really comes down to the little things that we do over time that add up to being able to really trust one another. When Brené Brown talks about building trust, she often starts with a story about her daughter, Ellen. When Ellen was in the third grade, she came home from school. She burst through the door of their house in tears and confided in her mother that a classmate she told her mom that a classmate of hers, she had confided something in her classmate. It wasn't even a big thing. Kind of a funny, maybe a little embarrassing, but really not a big thing. But by the time they got back into the classroom, every single girl in the class knew that story, right? I bet you everybody here has had that, or your first experience of betrayal or feeling like you've been betrayed when you trusted somebody with the confidence. And the kids, the girls, all started teasing her and giving her a hard time, so much so that their teacher separated them and took some marbles out of the marble jar. Ellen's teacher had a large glass vase or jar that she and the kids referred to as the marble jar. She kept a bag of colored marbles next to the jar, and whenever the class was making good choices, she would put some marbles in the jar. And if they were making not so great choices, being disrespectful, not listening, she would take marbles out of the jar. And if and when the marbles made it all the way to the top of the jar, the students would get to have a class party. That was their reward. And so after putting her anger, of course, Brené Brown is very angry on behalf of her daughter, and fearful. She doesn't want her to experience this hurt. She's thinking about, now how is she going to talk to her daughter about trust? And she thinks, oh, the marble jar. It's a perfect image. And she tells Ellen to think of her friendships as marble jars, right? When someone supports you or is kind to you or sticks up for you or honors what you share with them in private, you put marbles in the jar. And when people are mean or disrespectful or share your secrets, marbles come out. And then she asks Ellen if she has any marble jar friends, friends for whom the jar is mostly full. And Ellen says, yeah, I do have some marble jar friends, as a matter of fact. And these are some of the marbles that filled up their jars. Ellen's friends kept her secrets and shared some of their secrets with her. They remembered her birthday. They knew her family. They knew the names of her parents, her grandparents, her siblings. They included her in fun things and important activities. They knew when she was sad and asked why. And when she missed school because she was sick, they would ask their moms to call her mom and find out if she was okay. Not such big things, right? Things that happen in the course of everyday life. Our marble jar friends pay attention, right? And so we come back to this place of, can we calm ourselves? Can we slow ourselves down enough to be mindful of what's going on with the people around us? Can we be mindful enough to pay attention to what's important to them? They stay connected that way. They hold our secrets. They share our joys. Help us hold our burdens. All one marble at a time. It's not the big betrayals where you feel like you got to dump the whole jar out. It's the little everyday things. And there's another really great image that comes from John Gottman. He's a couples researcher who studies the science of relationships. He writes, "What I've found through research is that trust is built on very small moments, which he calls sliding door moments. In any interaction, there's the possibility of connecting or turning away, sliding the door open or shut." And he gives this example. "One night, I really wanted to finish my mystery novel. We've all been there. I thought I knew who the killer was, but I was anxious to find out. At one point in the night, I put the novel on my bedside and walked into the bathroom, and as I passed the mirror, I saw my wife's face in the reflection, and she looked sad. She was brushing her hair. There was a sliding door moment. I had a choice. I could sneak out of the bathroom and think, I don't really want to deal with her sadness tonight. I want to read my novel. But instead, because I am a sensitive researcher of relationships, I did go into the bathroom. I took the brush from her hair and asked, 'What's the matter, baby?' And she told me why she was sad. Now, at that moment, I was building trust. I was there for her. I was connected with her rather than choosing to think only about what I wanted. These are the moments we've discovered that build trust. One such moment is not that important, but if you're always choosing to turn away, then trust erodes in a relationship very gradually, very slowly. And we turn away from each other all the time. Usually not meaning to. We're too busy, too preoccupied to stop and really pay attention to each other." I was telling Candy about my image that I like to use, and that is of a congregation as a petri dish. Y'all remember what that's like from biology class in high school? A little place where experiments happen. Right? So in this petri dish, we have an opportunity to conduct experiments about how we want to be in the world with one another, right? We get to be intentional about what we want to put into that petri dish when we're here with each other. The practice of taking time to slow down and really focus on being here with one another that we can choose to make part of our life here together today, right now. We can set an intention to turn towards one another, to practice paying attention and staying engaged with one another. We can covenant with one another to try to build trusting relationships. And like ripples on a pond, it begins right here. Connection, engagement, trust, love. And this is where I may have bitten off more than I can chew this morning. Because I cannot help but imagine those ripples of trust going out from this congregation into this community, into this town, into this state, into this country, and into the world. Can we even begin to imagine what life would be like if we may trust the foundation on which we all built our lives together? I've come to believe that the worst betrayal of all in our time is disengagement. People divided into camps and circling the wagons, building walls around themselves for protection that keep us divided and hurting one another. And there's that one line in the song the choir just sang. This is a song for all of us singing with love and the will to trust. The will to trust. Can we imagine what life would be like if we shared the will to trust? Trust and betrayal are feelings that we rarely discuss in the public arena. And I think we'd all be better served to try and understand that part of the deeper story. I want to share with you a little bit of what I've been reading from a book that's called Strangers in Their Own Land. I don't know if any of you have had a chance to see it. Sociologist Arlie Hochschild. She actually lives in Berkeley, California, and she realizes what a bubble that is of like-minded people. And so she decided to take some time away, and she went and really spent some deep time engaging with people in Southwest Louisiana, a place very different from Berkeley, California, trying to understand the deeper story of Tea Party supporters there. She wants to make a conscious effort to climb what she calls the empathy wall, and I think this term is invaluable, the empathy wall, to try to engage with people who seem to be working against their own interests, to try to understand the feelings behind the rhetoric, the stories behind what we are all seeing from a great distance. And she writes, "You might say I'd come to Louisiana with an interest in walls, not visible physical walls such as those separating Catholics from Protestants in Belfast, Americans from Mexicans on the Texas border, or once residents of East and West Berlin. It was empathy walls that interested me. An empathy wall is an obstacle to deep understanding of another person, one that can make us feel indifferent or even hostile to those who hold different beliefs and whose childhood is rooted in different circumstances. In a period of political turmoil, we grasp for quick certainties. We shoehorn new information into ways we already think. We settle for knowing our opposite numbers from the outside. But is it possible, without changing our beliefs, to know others from the inside, to see reality through their eyes, to understand the links between life, feeling, and politics, that is, to cross the empathy wall?" I think here the operative word is feelings. The feelings behind the experience. She calls this the deeper story or the deep story. And she said, "The deep story was to take me to the should and shouldn'ts of feeling, to the management of feeling, and to the core of feeling stirred by charismatic leaders." Everyone has a deep story. And so she shares people's experiences. She talks about this one fellow named Lee Sherman who worked for a big chemical company down in Louisiana. Part of his job was regularly dumping toxic waste into the bayou, illegally. And he knew that what he was doing was wrong, but he needed the job. He didn't feel like he had a choice. 15 years later, he was doused with chemicals that literally burned the clothes off of his body, leaving him too ill to work. And instead of paying for his disability, the company fires him for absenteeism. Right? And so when all the fish in the area start dying, the chemical company, of course, denies culpability. Lee Sherman, now an environmentalist, barged into a public hearing with a huge sign that read, "I'm the one who dumped those chemicals in the bayou." Can you imagine all the feelings associated, all the feelings of betrayal in particular, and guilt associated with his life and the circumstances of his life and actions over the years? Fast forward a couple of decades later, he's campaigning for a congressman who wants to gut the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Does it make sense? It does if you've been betrayed by big business and the federal government. Lee Sherman has learned to place his trust in what's closest to home for him, family, church, and very local politics, all within his own bubble of like-minded people. Arlie Horschild calls this the great paradox: opposition to federal assistance for people in places that really need it. It feels a lot like a castle without a drawbridge. Nothing gets in, whether people need it or not. It's not logical, but it makes sense. At least it makes sense to me. Not completely, but it makes some sense to me. We all have trouble climbing the empathy wall with people who don't share our values, our worldview. But when we stop trying to listen, to learn, to understand, when we disengage, we turn away from one another without really knowing those deeper stories, those feelings, that empathy that connects us. Without those connections, we lose sight of our interdependence, our need for one another. Because, my friends, we're all in this together. And so we lose sight of our interconnectedness at our own peril. And now I'm really going to fling the net wide, because I want to share a clip from you, with you, from one of my favorite television shows, Madam Secretary. It's an episode called E Pluribus Unum, our nation's motto, out of many, one. And it's a little speech about the perils of losing sight of our interconnectedness.
Mr. Wedaley, your courage and determination have made humankind safer from the second greatest threat it faces. What is an even greater threat than nuclear weapons? That which makes the use of them possible: hate. Specifically, the blind hatred one group or nation can have for another. And that is why I am convinced that nationalism is the existential threat of our time. I want to be clear, nationalism is not the same as patriotism. It's a perversion of patriotism. Nationalism, the belief system held by those who attacked us, promotes the idea that inclusion and diversity represent weakness, that the only way to succeed is to give blind allegiance to the supremacy of one race over all others. Nothing could be less American. Patriotism, on the other hand, is about building each other up and embracing our diversity as the
source of our nation's strength. We the people means all the people.
America's heroes didn't die for race or region. They died for the ideals enshrined in our Constitution. Above all, freedom from tyranny, which requires our unwavering support of a free press, freedom of religion, all religions, the right to vote, and making sure nothing infringes on any of those rights which belong to us all. Look where isolationism has gotten us in the past. 2 world wars, 70 million dead. Never again can we go back to those dark times when fear and hatred, like a contagion, infected the world. That, as much as ending the threat of nuclear war, is what today is about. And it's why we must never lose sight of our common humanity, our common values, and our common decency.
I was reminded recently of our nation's founding motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one.
13 disparate colonies became one country, one people, and today we call on all Americans and people everywhere to reject the scourge of nationalism. Because governments can't legislate tolerance or eradicate hate. That's why each one of us has to find the beauty in our differences instead of the fear. Listen instead of reacting. Reach out instead of recoiling. It's up to us, all of us. Thank you.
Okay, that's my little pep talk, guys. Listen. Listen to one another. Reach out. You may not be able to reach out to folks in Southwest Louisiana, but there are people in the circles on either side of us, if you think of our worlds as concentric circles. And we can reach out to people who are different outside of our circle, who are closer to our circle than farther away. And I believe it's reaching our hands across those borders. People in this town, maybe even people in this congregation that are different from you, and practicing building trust. That's where the hope lies for me. That's where the hope lies for all of us, I do believe. Thank you, Sandy, for making that happen. And I just want to end with some words that are actually in our hymnal. They're words from Adrienne Rich. I want to leave you with these words. She writes, "My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world." Reconstitute the world. I have to believe we can build trusting relationships. It's not an extraordinary power, but it's one, I believe, that does have the power to reconstitute the world. May it be so. Blessed be, and amen. I invite you now to stand as you're able, willing and able, and let's sing together, "This Old World."